I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
People are kind of amazed how prescient, you know, Dick is, and it just proves it once again. I mean, I didn't have some Hollywood audience in mind. The audience here is Dick fans.
Here is a Philip K. Dick film that's rich in dialogue.
It's both optimistic and funny, that's his tone, and it's really tragic, too, and sad. It's a cautionary tale, but, you know, so's The Godfather, so's Goodfellas.
Right.
You know, gangsters like those movies.
Do you have, like, any concept of or conception of Substance D? I was trying to think of what the drug experience is compared to experiences I've had.
There's no weekend warriors on the D. You're either on it or you haven't tried it. Let's get the spirit of that humor, that banter, the paranoia, everything about it. Let's tell the whole story here. He deserves that.
Here at the Are You Serious Show, we just can't get enough Dick. And we're also pretty wet for film director Rick Linklater. So today is a perfect storm because we'll be talking to Rick Linklater about his new film, A Scanner Darkly, based on the Philip K. Dick novel of the same name. And it is our first birthday party. We're playing with the figures a little bit, but we're saying it's our first birthday party. And to honor that, we, of course, have Jeff Deal, Steve Robles. Brian Mallow is hanging out in the background to help us talk to Dick because he's like a total dickhead. And the fabulous Diana Brown.
Well, thank you, Are You, gentlemen. It's great to be here. I think you'll recall earlier this week, Jeff Deal directed our attention to, I have to say, a truly amazing article featured in Volume 12, Issue Number 2 of Skeptic Magazine Online. And in this article, scientist and science fiction writer David Brin carries intelligent design creationism to its logical conclusion by showing the numerous other alternatives to Darwinian evolution that creationists don't want you to know about. Now, Brin goes on and explains how the proponents of ID are no longer utilizing the Bible. Instead, they're evoking criticism and citing alleged faulty evidence as reasons to teach students alternatives to evolution. But as he points out, you know, for the millions of people out there that's the target of their actions, this battle is a emotional and symbolic as ever. But they've changed their armory of symbols and their ideas, and they're using basically co-opting terms far more the lexicon of science than religion, most notably fair play and completeness. Now, David Brin says one might paraphrase the new position that's been expressed by President Bush and many others as follows. What do evolutionists have to fear? Are they so worried about competition and criticism that they must censor what bright students are allowed to hear? Okay, so this is where it really gets interesting. He explains how they're shooting themselves in the foot if they get what they really want. And to prove his point, he cites five other options to Darwinian evolution.
Of course, I mean, he phrases it as alternatives to Darwinian evolution, but they're not. I mean, they're theories of origins.
There are other
whereas
theories.
Whereas Darwin is biology. So I've said this too many times on this show, but they're just...
They've got
the things in the wrong boxes. I mean, it's basically, one is biology and the other is cosmogony, the origins of the universe, which is still up for grabs unless, like,
exactly.
you worship random chance.
Well, as you just pointed out, you know, you're not alone in this, and recent cosmologists have come up with the concept, especially this evolution of intelligent designers, in which they suggest that, you know, a large black hole forms in our universe and it serves as an egg for the creation of yet an entirely new baby universe that detaches from ours and begins its own complete existence.
What is the teat in that in that scenario.
Where is the teat in the origin of the universe?
Yeah. Well, you're talking about offspring and parental.
I think that's a great question, and I think that you would probably find people that would be able to support just where that teat was, and I think that's his point. Each of these viewpoints.
By God, if the universe.
By God, there's a teat out there for this universe.
Yes. The universe at large isn't mammalian, then what's the point?
I think there are many boobs who agree with this theory. We are here with Richard Linklater and his current film, which everybody has been very anxious to see for a long time, Scanner Darkly, based, of course, on the Philip K. Dick novel of the same name. And as everybody is well aware, we love Dick here at the Are You Serious show. And, Richard, this may be the first Philip K. Dick film made by a true fan, or from what I understand, you are a true fan. Can you say something about the impact of his writing and his novels on you?
Well, I am a big fan. I've read a lot, but I'm not one of those who's read everything and I never made it through the whole exegesis, and I haven't, don't claim he's a Gnostic deity, but I do think he's a fantastic novelist. He's a great imagination, a great, sense of humanity. I love his characters, and I've always, just enjoyed the way he thought and everything about him, and I always responded to Scanner. I thought it was a very personal book of his. It felt like I could always relate to it. It felt like a movie that I could make. A bunch of guys hanging out talking about cars and things,
Right. A bunch of guys getting twisted and talking about cars and things.
That's one level. Obviously there's a whole nother level to the book, but even that seemed very very of the moment, It's a good, I think people are starting to see this movie now. I'm having to talk about it a little bit. And it's like people are kind of amazed how prescient, Dick is. And it just proves it once again, that this book he wrote almost 30 years ago. And people are going, gosh, it's so contemporary. And I'm like, yeah, no kidding. The guy, all the future,
Yeah, it definitely does have a 21st century kind of vibe. Did you get a headache trying to figure out how to convey, actors' sort of inner conspiracy to get across the varying things that were going on inside his head? You did it pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult in a movie. Literature can do that much easier, to portray an interior state, without having too much voiceover, it's there a little bit and you get the feeling, but it's tricky because he's, Bob Arctor is several different people ultimately, and he's how far gone he is an issue, and the reality of any moment, Keanu Reeves worked so hard on this. I mean, he was just kind of obsessed and he dug in deeply and there were times we'd look at each other and go, okay, this is insane. We don't know, he's where is Bob right now? No, he's not even here. He's Fred, So it was fun. It's fun to do something so out there,
Definitely.
Where you create your own reality, really.
Definitely a character that you can get lost in. Do you have any concept of or conception of Substance D? I was trying to think of what the drug experience is compared to experiences I've had.
We talked a lot about that. What is, and it's just vague enough in the book, and you just had to think of it from a kind of a manufacturer's standpoint. That's kind of like when you try to depict science fiction. Everything in this movie, you had to it's practical. So we're thinking, okay, a scramble suit, how does it function? It's not just a cool idea. It's got to be functional to be a real product in a real world. And the same thing with Substance C. It's like, what kind of drug is it? It's not just, I was kind of going off of, I remember in the 70s, there was this notion of there needs to be, or where I first heard it the first time, everybody was saying, there needs to be a designer drug that isn't harmful, isn't addictive, and yet allows the user to kind of transcend you know, the reason people do drugs or alcohol, you know, people have to kind of transcend themselves and alter time. You know, the human psyche,
right,
some degree requires that, right?
Yeah.
And so, instead of that utopian notion and that healthy notion of what that drug would be, I thought just the opposite. Substance D is a drug that is immediately addictive and expensive enough to get you, you know, you have to work and, you know, it's profitable for the whoever's selling and making it. And then also, for more sinister, it hops out and you kind of lose yourself, and yet you're still alive and able to be kind of slave labor. So it's your most paranoid drug you could imagine, where the effects we could imagine are somewhat euphoric, but I think it's mainly its addictiveness that I thought was key. Because if you really could do a drug that was immediately addictive, as Robert Downey Jr. describes in the movie, and this isn't in the book, I worked a lot of this out with Robert, actually. He contributed heavily to this, as he'll jokingly say, his 20-plus years of research into this very subject.
I was going to say, he did a lot of research, and your choice of performers in the film, of course, Woody Harrelson and Winona Ryder as well. Excellent casting
Robert,
there.
Robert's the only one on record, I think, of having, you know, he's the only one in the books, I believe, or who did time, let's put it like that.
Right.
Poor guy. But he contributed that line, you're either on it or you haven't tried it, when we're describing D. And there's no Weekend Warriors on the D. You're either on it or you haven't tried it.
It's kind
so
of
that was our imagining what this drug is, but it ultimately allows you to be, you know, the perfect worker. You don't even know your name, but you're able to be a slave laborer, you know. So I just think Philip K. Dick would appreciate, you know, that, you know, because that's what he's getting at. Your worst nightmare scenario for yourself.
It's kind of like Soma, but then the right side of your brain leaks into the left side of your brain, and then you die. So
Yeah. Huxley was coming from a much more utopian, healthy standpoint. You know, he saw drugs in such a positive light, which I always love that about him. You know, anybody who reads Doors of Deception, and he was such an early hallucinogenic researcher himself,
right?
And knew so much about it. But his perspective is always so kind of healthy and religious, holistic. Whereas we had to imagine the sinister New Path or whoever manufacturing the substance D could give a shit about that, right? They're thinking, you know, how to induce slave labor and sell these things. So,
right. I mean, in that sense, it's like heroin, the perfect drug for capital and so forth.
Yeah.
So I read. Okay.
Well, hey, Richard. This is Brian.
Hi.
How was it working with, I guess you worked pretty closely with Philip K. Dick's estate, with his daughters, and they really approved more so than they have previous script. They really liked your script for the film, right?
Yeah, I feel very lucky because, I mean, they took an active interest in this only because it was such a personal book for their father. You know, Issa Hackett, his youngest daughter, told me, you know, she said, just so you know, I went up to, you know, to the Bay Area there and met with them. And they had read my script and liked it, but they still wanted to talk to me and try to make sure, tonally speaking, I was, I mean, they always wanted this to be a cautionary tale. The first thing they told me is like, well, you know, our father would still be writing if it wasn't for drugs, you know? And I said, yeah, it's a tragedy that he went at 53. You know, I mean, the older, when I was 22, when he died, it's like, okay, well, he's an old guy, you know, he's got a lot of books, not so bad. But, you know, at 45 now, 53 seems incredibly young and tragic a year to go, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and it is. We have lost over two decades of new Philip K. Dick work. You know, so that's a tragedy. And she told me I left the memoriam from the book at the end of the movie. And she says, just so you know, she points at one name, she goes, that's my father, because Phil put himself on the list, right?
I was wondering about that.
And then she points to someone else, another lady, on the list, and goes, well, and that's my mother.
Mm.
So just so you know. And she goes, and then I can only assume, that means you're one of the little girls who he imagines he has. He lives in the house. And she goes, yeah, we moved out and those guys moved in, you know, so that was, it was a book so close to them that they were just sort of, they didn't want it to be one of those stories of their dads that gets, you know, you mine a few ideas from and make another kind of movie altogether. And they certainly didn't want me to be cavalier with the drug attitude. So I was like, yeah, I mean, I want to make this. I think it can't help but be a cautionary anti-drug message. But at the same time, I didn't want to make something that was vacuous and, oh, just say no. You know, I wanted to show the upside or how it happens, or the communal aspects and the exuberance that you often find in that environment.
Yeah, I mean, your characters aren't just burnouts. They're sort of burnouts and brilliant at the same time, which is a, you know, very druggy thing.
We've all had those roommates and maybe been that ourselves. Who knows?
I roomed with myself for a while.
I always thought in Dick's own words, I think in there in his afterword, he says that this really was his experience. He pretty much, he almost, it makes you laugh to think that really your experience of those years in the 60s or 70s somehow gets translated into these holo scanners and scramble suits. And to him, it's just exactly what he experienced.
Yeah, this is my reality. This is autobiographical.
Yeah.
Fantastic ideas of identity and scramble suits. But I think that's how he worked. I mean, who knows? But I think he did work from such a personal place for his general arc of character and everything. And then I think he came back in, puts on the elements that keeps it kind of in his genre or what he was comfortable with. And I think he's, for him, probably just thinking about the paranoia of this drug war run amok, which wasn't even a drug war yet. You know, it wasn't officially declared, I guess. But, yeah, for him, that was reality, you know?
Right, he was experiencing a paranoid inner world as well as whatever was going on the outside.
Very valid. I mean, you know, his apartment had been broken into. He had kind of come through those Nixon years and extremely paranoid. I've seen interviews with him where he's talking about everyone who visited his house, license plates were taken. He had, in his FBI file, I mean, he really thought he was an enemy of the state and was identified as such. But how could you help? You know, someone with as you know, dangerous a mind as he has, how could he not think that? But in reality, you know, it seems like he did get his files and everything, and there was really nothing in there. So he had that sense of humor, similar to Freck. He has bugs crawling all over him, and then he looks back at the jar, and they're all gone, you know. So I think that was personal to him, too, to think, oh, you know, they're watching my every move. I'm that important to them. You know, we all would imagine we would be dangerous the way Martin Luther King is dangerous, where they actually are taping everything he does. And then you realize, you know, I'm not really on their radar. I'm just a ghetto sci-fi novelist that no one cares about, you know.
It's nice to feel cosmically important once in a while, I guess. Mm-hmm. We're going to break for a couple of minutes and listen to some music, and then we'll be right back with Richard Link later.
Serious. On the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breeze blows. A crazy lady living in a bag, eating out of cotton pills, used to be a bag hag, such a dance to tango, skipped it like a tango. A circon Christian seen a lost her senses, down at the peep show, watching all the creep, so she could tell the stories to the girls back home. She went to the city and got so-so's and did it, she had to get a picture, couldn't make it on her own. Don't push me,
cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. My brother's doing fast on my mother's TV. Says she watches too much, it's just not healthy. All my children in the daytime, Dallas at night. Can't even see the game or the Sugar Ray fight. Bill collectors to ring my phone and scare my wife when I'm not home. Got a bum education, double digits inflation. Can't take the train to the job, there's a strike at the station. Neon King Kong standing on my back, can't stop to turn around. Broke my sacroiliac, mid-range migraine, cancer the membrane. Sometimes I think I'm going insane, I swear I might hijack a plane. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. My son said, Daddy, I don't want to go to school because the teacher's a jerk. He must think I'm a fool. And all the kids smoke reefer. I think it'd be cheaper if I just got a job, learn to be a street sweeper. But dance to the beat, chuck for my feet, wear a shirt and tie, and run with the creeps. Because it's all about money, ain't a damn thing funny. You got to have a con in this land of milk and honey. They pushed that girl in front of the train, took her to the doctor, sewed her arm on her hand. Stabbed that man right in his heart, gave him a transplant for a brand new start. I can't walk through the park, but it's crazy after dark. Keep my hand on my gun, cause they got me on the run. I feel like an outlaw, broke my last glass jaw. Hit him, say, you want some more? Living on the seesaw. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. Say what? It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Say what?
So I read this review, actually, I don't know if you've seen it, I think it was on Slate, and the basic idea was that your project throughout your films is to sort of portray slacking as a valid anti-authoritarian strategy. It seemed like you were almost alluding to that in your earlier question and saying, well, no, it's really sort of a farce, but is that does that resonate with you? Is there some kind of continuing project starting with slackers that rings true to you?
Well, it feels very real to me, like what I portrayed in Slacker, you know, way back when was, you know, that's by and large a lot of how we all spend our lives,
right?
You know, hopefully not working. It's what you do when you're not working, and I don't see anything wrong with that, you know, intelligent people kind of communicating to one another, being obsessed, or, you know, at least everyone's minds are active, you know. I've never shown people like just sitting on the couch watching TV. You know, I've always shown people actively, intellectually engaged. It might be a little out there. It might seem a little obsessed, but to me, that's healthy. That's a sign of health in a population. People who aren't obsessed with their job, I mean, but who are, you know, thinking about things and putting things together, however strangely, I think that's pretty optimistic. You know, that's pretty real, you know, for thinking people out there. So, and to not be so attached, you know, to the system, so encumbered with the idea of your profession or who knows, you know. But I didn't read that thing you just talked about. I haven't read that, but what you said, that I kind of stand by that. Yeah, sure.
All right, you might want to think about that. That might be your aesthetic. They might have laid it out there for you. The great thing about Scanner Darkly, Many Here is a Philip K. Dick film that's rich in dialogue as compared to, say, some of the other ones that were sort of action thrillers. And so, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I see how it happens, though. I mean, Hollywood has a strange way of, when the budget gets up there, you need to hit some tried and true notes of genre to get audiences in, whether it's action, thriller, violence, you know, things like that. I mean, it's just kind of the deal you make with the public in general, which hasn't really worked for Philip K. Dick so well. I mean, we all have our favorites here and there of movies that have been made from his work, but my goal, I've always been a little bit disappointed in so many of them that they seem to lack the humor and the dialogue, that those are the right first to go. But I see why now. It was such a challenge. It was probably the hardest thing for me to hang on to. You know, you get the note from people like, well, just cut that bicycle scene. Like, it's a scene you could cut out and no one would miss it. I'm like, so? Yeah, no one would know. But it's a good thing. It says everything. You know, it says everything about them. It's funny. It's like, so you have to fight for these kinds of things because movie making, by and large, is obsessed with storytelling. It's always about moving the story forward. And long dialogue stretches, funny stuff, that's material that seems digressive, is the first to go. Let's leave the action, let's leave the forward momentum of the story, let's leave all that, and let's drop all these funny scenes that seemingly don't go anywhere. So the only way I was able to get away with it is that we did this movie for very little money. We had a $6 million budget to start, and I had, you know, the cast I have, which is, you know, just this wonderful cast, Keanu, Woody Harrelson, Robert Downey Jr., Winona, Rory Cochrane, you know, so they were just big enough names and stars that we kind of got to do this. I had final cut on the movie, so I was determined to just go with this, knowing it would work, like that's the story to be told here.
I think the readers of the novel would have missed the bicycle scene very much. I mean, that's definitely a great moment in the novel.
I certainly would have. I would have felt cheated. Or Freck's suicide, for instance. Things like that. Yeah. Those sequences that ring are some of the best in the novel that, yeah, I think you'd miss them, even though technically you don't need them. But I never believed that. You know, you do need them.
Was there something
that I was making this film for? I mean, I really didn't. I didn't have some Hollywood audience in mind. Audience here is Dick fans, people who like the book and like what he's about as a writer. I was just determined to, let's get the spirit of that humor, that banter, the paranoia, everything about it. Let's tell the whole story here. He deserves that, you know? He's one of the greatest novelists, you know? He deserves
it. Absolutely. So it sounds like you felt some obligation to his fans and to him?
Yeah. I mean, just like what a Peter Jackson say about Lord of the Rings, his obligation was to the fan and him, you know? He's like, I'm the fan. I'm making this for me, you know? And I felt the same way. That's when you know you're the right guy to be doing it. Like, Peter Jackson felt that way about Lord of the Rings. I'm making this, you know, because I love the material, and this is the movie I want to see. And that's how I felt making Scanner. I was like, this is the movie I would like to see from this book. You know, there's no other consideration. You know, and me, as a Philip K. Dick fan, as a big fan of this book, that's the best you can kind of aim for. And then, you know, if you come up short, you come up short. At least you're trying to go that way, you know, not like cavalierly throwing out these elements, you know. So I don't know. That's the challenge. And it's a less commercial movie than, I mean, you probably could have, you know, taken the notion of an undercover narcotics officer who's in the scramble suit and assigned a spy on yourself and some roommate turns against you. You could have tweaked that up and made something probably a little more, you know, jacked up.
Turned it into a thriller kind of thing.
In the way they did Blade Runner from Do Androids.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, and give it a happy ending.
Right.
You know, kind of,
It was sort of a happy ending. He had his little flower and going into it.
What do you think about that? Is it because I think that's a great measure of art in general when there's ambiguity. And I've had this conversation with a good friend of mine about whether the ending is optimistic or pessimistic. What do you think?
I know. I mean, when people say, "Oh, it's such a downer," I said, "Did you not see the end? He put the blue flower in the booth."
Right.
I mean, we're going to expose New Path and, you know, this whole thing. I mean, it's I think the ending is just, Philip K. Dick has the perfect pitch for an ending because it's like, and it's the pitch of the whole work. I'm convinced it's both optimistic and funny. That's his tone. And it's really tragic, too, and sad.
Yeah.
And I think you can still feel hopeful that an evil entity such as New Path could be brought down and some good could come out of this. But then you have to feel really tragic for Bob Harker, right?
Right.
That he's now this kind of husk, as they say, a burnt-out husk of a man who, whether he'll ever come back, we don't know. I mean, he's been used in such a big way. So I don't know. I mean, it's a little bit of both. I mean, you got to feel sorry for his inner being at the moment, but I don't know.
Hey, we're going to have to let you go. We're running out of time here, but I do have one more thing I wanted to ask you about. You were saying that you viewed the film as sort of a cautionary tale, which it definitely is, but then at the same time, it's going to be like a stoner midnight classic. So that's kind of interesting, I guess. You have any thoughts about that?
You know, it's a cautionary tale, but, you know, so's The Godfather, so's Goodfellas.
Right.
You know, gangsters like those movies.
Sure.
You know, do people really need to know? I mean, if you've got drug problems, or if you're doing the dangerous kind of drugs that can kill you on a Saturday night or any time you take them, you know, that, I don't know, do you really need, you don't need a lecture, you know? Or maybe,
you need to watch a good movie.
Yeah.
Thanks.
To watch a good movie.
Yeah. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us on a Saturday night.
Okay.
All right, man. Take care.
Okay, good talking to you guys.
All right.
Thanks.
This has been the Are You Serious Show. See you next time.
Love is the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?